Hammond was telling Durrani the truth about his insurance policy. The ISI's network had picked up chatter about an email Rickman sent to the FSB exposing a high-level agent stationed in Istanbul. This had been confirmed by a rendition attempt thwarted by Mitch Rapp that left two Russians dead. Most critically, the email had been sent after Rickman's death. Todd smiled thinly. It was hard not to appreciate the man's brilliance. From beyond the grave, he would set fire after fire, running Kennedy and her people ragged. It was a plan that had gotten off to a rousing start. Even if that whore prostrated herself in front of the director of the FSB, the already tense relations between America and Russia would further worsen. There was little doubt that plans for reprisals were in the works at the Kremlin. It was tempting to just let Rickman's strategy play out, to sit on the sidelines and watch the CIA blow itself apart. Tempting, but impossible. Rickman's plan for revenge against his former employer was akin to an IED, powerful but indiscriminate. If Taj could possess the information, particularly if he could do so without Kennedy knowing, it could be transformed from an explosive to a scalpel. With it, he would not only ferret out every traitor in his own government, but co-opt the Americans' entire network. Under the threat of exposure, he could quietly turn the CIA's most sensitive assets and monitor or kill the others. Critical spies they believed to be loyal would in fact be working for the ISI. They would provide him with an endless stream of information about U.S. intelligence efforts while feeding back a carefully formulated mix of truth and lies. He wouldn't just blind the world's most powerful spy agency, he would enslave it. Kabir Gadai was personally leading the team trying to track the law firm Rickman had spoken of, but the task had proved difficult. The CIA man hid his activities with incredible care, and also created countless false trails, each of which had to be diligently followed. Now that he was dead, though, Rickman's maze had stopped expanding. The picture began to clear. There was a knock on the door, and Taj took off his headphones before closing the laptop on his desk. "Come!" Kabir Gadai strode in and closed the door behind him. Most people were unaware that they were second cousins, and looking at them would offer no hint of the relationship. Gadai was good-looking, well-dressed, and outwardly accomplished. He was truly devoted to his three gifted sons and portrayed the necessary fondness for his daughter. His wife was beautiful and charming, but, more important, willing to overlook his extramarital affairs in return for a life of privilege. It was an immoral lifestyle that Taj had learned to tolerate in light of Gadai's competence and loyalty. Of course, like all men, Gadai had weaknesses. While his infidelity was problematic, his egocentric need for those around him to be aware of his accomplishments was far worse. Taj excused it as the exuberance of youth. But until Gadai matured, he would have to be watched with extra care.
"Do you have news about Rickman's attorney?"
They had traced the Sitting Bull information dump to the general area of Rome, but that left hundreds of individual firms to investigate. Gadai laid a dossier on Taj's desk, and the ISI director opened it. He immediately recognized the name of the Italian law firm.
"We already looked into them, no? They were helping Rickman create anonymous financial trusts with money he'd siphoned off from the CIA's Afghanistan operation, to benefit his children, if I recall correctly."
"You do," Gadai said. "After we confirmed that his connection with the firm related to personal affairs, we moved on."
Taj felt his grudging admiration for the CIA man grow further. More of Rickman's complex web. He hadn't hidden his personal activities as carefully as he could have, calculating that anyone who found the firm he used would assume that it wouldn't also be involved in his plot against the agency.
"Then you have him. You know the identity of the lawyer," Taj said, trying to keep his voice even despite the excitement he felt.
"I'm afraid it isn't that easy, Ahmed. It's a very large firm, and Rickman didn't use the same lawyer that he used for the trusts."
"What about the managing partner? Can we interrogate him?"
"He's a very public and very well-connected man in Italy.
Also, I very much doubt he would know anything. While we understand the importance of the files, this arrangement would be unremarkable to the firm. Essentially just
a schedule of electronic documents to be sent if certain criteria are met. It's unlikely the attorney handling the details would even know that his client is dead. And it's almost certain that he would be in the dark as to the contents of the files. This time, Rickman had displayed his cleverness by taking a page out of Taj's own book. Make everything too commonplace to attract attention. It was infuriating. He was within a hair's breadth of closing his fist around Irene Kennedy's delicate throat.
So, you're telling me that we have to investigate hundreds of individual lawyers whose careers are predicated on confidentiality in hopes that they left some clue about a client they never met? That's unacceptable, Kadir.
The younger man smiled, his eyes shining with an arrogant light that Taj was very familiar with.
That I knew something, but had withheld it for effect.
Don't make me wait, Kadir. I've indulged your sense of drama in the past, but my patience is at its end.
My apologies, Director. Our research suggests that this firm has a dedicated division that handles these kinds of arrangements. Scheduling, payments, requests for information, notifications.
How many people are in this division?
It's largely automated. Most of the work is done by computer, or...
How many?
Gadai opened the dossier again, shuffling to a photo of a plump woman with dyed blonde hair. Isabella Accorso runs the entire enterprise with a single administrative assistant. Taj picked up the photo and examined the woman's face. She was probably in her mid-30s, wearing a blouse that clung to her breasts in an obvious attempt to facilitate the faceless, nameless sexual encounters so enjoyed by Western women. It was hard to believe that this female had the keys to America's heavily guarded intelligence apparatus, that she unwittingly possessed more information on the CIA's operations than anyone outside Langley's executive offices.
What do we know about her?
She's divorced, clean, no drugs or illegal activity, no affairs or significant financial problems. Taj just glared at him. Again, his assistant's expression suggested there was more. She does have a daughter, though, a 16-year-old who attends public school. Quite an attractive young woman.
Can I assume she's accessible to us?
Gadai smiled. Easily.
Chapter 12. The Farm, near Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, USA.
Did you get it put back together? Rapp said as he walked into the farm's basement bar. Hurley was standing next to the pool table, with a ubiquitous drink in his hand, while Scott Coleman was beneath the elaborate scale model with a screwdriver.
"Just finishing," the old man said, lighting a cigarette. "The little twit outdid himself."
He was right. It was an impressive effort, even by Marcus Dumont standards. The computer genius had used a drone-mounted camera to take more than 1,000 high-definition photos of Leo Obrecht's property. After stitching them together in Photoshop, he'd fed them to the railroad car-sized 3D printer at Langley. Rapp had been expecting a 2-foot-square monochrome model with enough detail to make some general strategy decisions. What he'd gotten was a full-color model so large it had to be cut into 3 sections to jam it down the elevator shaft. Resolution was detailed enough to differentiate individual plants in Obrecht's garden. The portion of the model that represented the house was built in detachable layers so that each floor could be removed in order to examine the layout of the one beneath. The only thing missing was furniture, an omission that Dumont seemed genuinely embarrassed about. He still hadn't been able to crack the banker's encryption and tie into his security cameras.
"Voila!"
Coleman said, connecting the last section and crawling out from under it. Rapp let his eyes drift from the mansion grounds out to the mountainous forest surrounding it. Every tree and rock, every road and stream, was faithfully represented. While he was normally suspicious of technology, this was an advance he could get used to. Hurley set his drink down on a section of open meadow already covered with rings from his glass.
"I remember when we'd have planned this up on the back of a napkin."
"The world moves forward, Stan," Coleman said, stepping back to admire the model.
You're wrong,
the old man replied, cigarette smoke rolling from his mouth as he spoke.
The world stands still. All that changes is the window dressing.
That's why I've always liked you, Stan, your sunny disposition. What do we know about the place? Rapp said, before Hurley could formulate an expletive-laced response. The estate itself is about 100 acres, and beyond that is a whole lot of rugged, heavily forested public land, Coleman said. I have Wick over there watching the place, and I can tell you that we'd be better off trying to break into Fort Knox. Does the public use the area for recreation? The former SEAL shook his head. No trail system. What you see in the model are just game trails or natural features.
The good news, Hurley said, is that Obrecht is no different than all the other royalty wannabes. He doesn't want to mix with the unwashed masses. It's miles before you get to his first neighbor.
Coleman agreed. There's just the one road. It's 21 miles long from where it turns off a 2-lane rural highway. Obrecht's at the end. The nearest house is 9 miles south, and the owners aren't using it right now. One caretaker. Guy is older than Stan, and just as deaf.
Fuck you, Hurley said.
Rapp returned his attention to the model of the banker's property. It was a common mistake made by men like Obrecht. The best security was to be packed in with 100 neighbors who knew the rhythms of the area and would notice any change. Those kinds of densely populated subdivisions also tended to have solid police coverage with short response times. What's the story with the fence? Rapp said.
It's more of a wall, Coleman replied. A little less than a foot thick, constructed of cinder blocks covered with adobe. We talked to the contractor who built it, and he said the whole thing is reinforced with concrete.
Height?
About 12 feet. One main gate about 15 feet wide and one small delivery door. Both look like they could stop a tank. Add to that floodlights, cameras, hardened positions along the wall, and you've got the makings of quite a party.
What about the men?
We're out of luck. The former special ops people Obrecht originally had in there are all gone. The guys he replaced them with look to be Middle Eastern and Eastern European.
The personnel change was bad news. Their best bet had been to get to the Western contractors protecting Obrecht through their military contacts. Most were former special forces, and that was a very small and very interconnected fraternity. Coleman seemed to read his mind.
So we can't get them to hand Obrecht their resignation and open the gate for us, but I knew one of the GSG-9 guys he canned. He gave me good intel on stuff in the house that didn't make it to the architectural plans. The highlights are that all the glass is bulletproof, and Obrecht has a safe room in the basement.
How many men does he have now?
12 that we can individually identify. It's possible that there are more inside who never come out, but I doubt it. Also 5 civilians, a butler, a cook, and 3 maids.
Dogs? Coleman shook his head.
We have...
The door to the bar opened, and Louis Gould stepped through, followed by Mike Nash. The assassin had been cleaned up and was wearing a donated pair of slacks and a blue dress shirt. No shoes, though, in case he was stupid enough to try to run. Coleman started to stretch out a hand, but stopped under the force of Rapp's glare. Gould had saved his life in Afghanistan, and while he knew it was just because the assassin couldn't afford to lose a good gun, there was no denying that he owed the man. There was also no denying that he wouldn't live long if Rapp ever had reason to question his loyalty.
"I don't think introductions are necessary," Nash said, trying to cut through the tension.
He had a gift for such things, but this time it didn't work. Rapp remained silent, tracking Gould as he approached the model on the pool table.
"Well," he said, leaning over it. "They always said you guys had the best toys. Now I believe it."
No one dared respond as Rapp continued to stare at the man. Gould was the only person he had ever felt conflicted about in his life. Sometimes he found himself wanting to trade places with him, living out a quiet retirement, surrounded by his family. Other times, he wanted to make Gould's wife a widow and leave his daughter fatherless. For now, though, they needed him. "Welcome aboard," Rapp said finally. The other men in the room relaxed, and Gould nodded respectfully.
"Thanks, Mitch."
"Now start earning your keep,"
Hurley growled. "Okay," Gould said, folding his arms across his chest.
"The wall is a lot stronger than you think it is, It goes down 3 feet, and Obrecht has the cinder blocks filled with cement. The windows are bulletproof, and he's got a safe room in the basement.
Coleman had already covered those bases, but the fact that Gould wasn't starting out with his normal string of lies was promising.
"What about dogs?" Rapp said.
Coleman hadn't had a chance to answer the question.
"I'd bet against it. Obrecht got attacked by one of his father's Dobermans when he was a kid. You can still see the scars on one side of his jaw. He's terrified of them."
Rapp glanced at Coleman, who gave a subtle nod, confirming the information.
"What's he got by way of guards?" Gould asked. 12 men, Coleman said. "All serious operators."
"That's more than he's had in the past. You must have spooked him. Can you get to any of them?"
"He canned all the Americans and Brits,"
Hurley said.
Gould nodded.
"He figured you might be able to turn them."
"That's the problem with Leo. He's not an idiot."
"How secure is a safe room?" Rapp asked.
"It's set into the bedrock in the basement. Foot-thick steel walls, separate oxygen supply, separate heating and cooling systems. You could burn the house down around it, and Obrecht would never break a sweat."
"So at the first sign of a breach, Obrecht's going to lock himself in there and wait us out," Rapp said.
"Scott, what about his communications?"
"We'll jam his wireless and cut his hard lines, but the amount of firepower we're going to have to use to get in there isn't going to go unnoticed, no matter how far away and deaf his neighbors are. We can clip into the police station's line and head off any phone traffic, but that's only going to buy us another 15 minutes or so."
They all fell silent, staring down at Dumont's model. Finally, Gould spoke.
"Since I've passed all the tests about bulletproof glass and dogs, let me tell you something you don't know. The safe room isn't all Obrecht has in that basement."
He grabbed a pool cue and pointed to the base of a wooded knoll southeast of the wall.
"There's an entrance to an escape tunnel that comes out here."
Rapp looked at Coleman, who shrugged.
"It's not on any plans, and his former guards don't know anything about it. Obrecht doesn't trust anyone. The safe room's good for the most likely threat that some crook he works with decides he knows too much. The tunnel is there in case his own guards or a government comes after him. I got lucky and stumbled across it while I was probing for weaknesses in his security. The access is hidden inside a small natural cave."
"Mostly lies, of course. Obrecht used that tunnel to smuggle in contraband that he wanted to make absolutely certain authorities never discovered. Usually, attractive young boys snatched from the streets of third world countries, but occasionally, also criminal associates like Gould."
"I can have my guys take a look," Coleman said.
Rapp gave a short nod, authorizing it.
"Can we get into the tunnel from that cave?"
"Shouldn't be a problem."
"Okay, then," Rapp said.
"As tempting as it is to just kick up a bunch of dust and wait for Obrecht to pop out, we can't risk it. With Rickman involved, there's always a chance that one of the guards is compromised and will take Obrecht out before we can get to him. Even more likely, he'll go for the safe room. In the end, the only way to be sure we get him out of there alive is to drag him out."
Chapter 13. Near Bakar, Pakistan. For this excursion, the aid agency Land Cruiser had been traded for an equally nondescript delivery truck. The vehicle was positioned in the middle of a regularly scheduled supply convoy, and Ahmed Taj was sitting in the passenger seat. The road was well maintained, and the surrounding landscape stretched empty and windswept to the horizon, a stark contrast to the crush of Pakistan's overcrowded cities. The facility coming into view had been designed to be unremarkable, and it remained so despite recent events. The warehouse-style building was fashioned from local materials, making it blend into its surroundings to the degree possible. The razor-wire-topped fence surrounding it was a commercially available variety, indistinguishable from millions of similar chain-link structures throughout the country. Most important, the facility actually did produce the textiles described by the placard on the gate, albeit by trusted men sourced from Pakistan's armed forces.
"I want to examine the damage myself," Taj said, as the lead vehicle eased to a stop in front of the gate. "I'll get out here."
His driver's stoic expression turned fearful.
"We have no way to know if the terrorists who carried out the assault have all been captured, Director. There could still be armed men in the area."
His reaction was understandable. the Pakistani Taliban, bent on bringing down the government, had attacked the facility less than 8 hours before. Despite that, the ISI director threw the door open and stepped onto the running board, not bothering to acknowledge his man's concerns.
"May I send the team with you, sir?"
"No."
The skies were typically clear, and a group of men encircling him could draw the attention of American satellites. According to his intelligence, the CIA was still ignorant of this and 19 similar properties scattered across Pakistan. In light of the extreme challenges associated with building and maintaining them, he wasn't anxious to jeopardize that ignorance. The army had managed to regain the appearance of normalcy with workmanlike speed. The massive hole in the fence to the east of the gate had been strung with wire in a way that, while not secure, would obscure the fact that a truck full of explosives had struck it just before dawn. A second weaponized vehicle had failed to detonate and was resting on its side, barely 10 meters from the building's main entrance. Now covered with camouflage netting, it would be invisible from above. The bodies of the 9 guards and 16 Taliban fighters who died in the attack had been dragged inside and would be hidden within a shipment of fabrics when the convoy left. Even bloodstains and burn marks had been eradicated, covered with fresh dirt before the sun had fully cleared the horizon. Taj slipped through a gap in the damaged fence, paying no attention to a soldier hidden in a stack of discarded pipes. The army sniper would have been made aware of his arrival. Taj passed through a rusted door in the side of the building and found himself in a dilapidated office that stunk of the chemicals used on the factory floor. The man sitting behind the only desk wore the threadbare shirt and tie of a factory manager, but was in fact the special forces officer in charge of security. He averted his eyes in well-deserved shame for what had happened and pressed a hidden button near his leg. The lock on the door across the room buzzed, and Taj pushed through it. The shop floor contained little to dispel the illusion of a legitimate factory. Workers manned a variety of industrial machines, and massive plastic-wrapped bolts of fabric were stacked around the walls. It would take a well-trained eye to see the irregularities in the concrete floor that hid 4 of Pakistan's 117 nuclear warheads. These in particular were attached to Shaheen 1A ballistic missiles developed with the help of the North Koreans. They were currently Pakistan's most technologically advanced, with a range of almost 2,000 kilometers and the rudimentary ability to evade missile defense systems. The building's sloped roof was attached with explosive bolts that, when detonated, would cause the entire assembly to slide away. This would allow the missiles to be raised and launched within minutes of an attack order. Ironically, much of the money for this structure came from the Americans. They were so fearful that terrorists might gain access to a WMD that they were willing to pump nearly unlimited funds into Pakistan's nuclear program. All the U.S. politicians asked in return was that the army maintain the illusion of improved security. The phone in his pocket began to vibrate, and he glanced around him before picking up. The workers were taking great pains to ignore his presence.
"Go ahead,"
he said, inserting a Bluetooth headset into his ear.
"You requested an update before I got on the plane to Rome?" Kabir Gadai said, his voice barely audible over the noise of the machinery.
He was on his way to convince Isabella Accorso to turn over the computer files her law firm had received from Joseph Rickman.
"Quickly,"
Taj said, continuing toward a door on the far side of the expansive building.
"Per your instructions, Obrecht is running ads in all the major newspapers worldwide, as well as the agreed-upon websites and magazines. He's also left encrypted messages in all the predetermined drop sites. So far, no response."
Disappointing, but in no way surprising. It was certain that the CIA had captured Louis Gould, but no information was available on his fate. Based on the assassin's history with Mitch Rapp, it was very possible that he was dead. Kennedy was a clever female, though she would be desperate to capture Obrecht, and the most promising strategy would be to offer Gould his life in return for assistance. That presented an opportunity for getting rid of Rapp.
"We're prepared to deal with an attack on Obrecht's property, then?"
Taj asked.
"Yes, though he's lodged endless complaints about being used as bait."
Taj was forced to step aside to let a front loader pass. Obrecht was less than nothing, a criminal who fed off the excitement of his debauched lifestyle, but only if the risks were laid at the feet of others.
I assume you've offered him money to put his mind at ease?
Among other things.
And the American and British guards have been replaced?
Yes, sir, with men who have no history with the CIA or U.S. military, and no love for America in general. All experienced.
If anything should go wrong, it will be time to deal with Obrecht. Under no circumstances is he to fall into Mitrap's hands.
It would be a shame to lose him, Gadai said. He's become very useful, but understood.
Taj slowed as he approached the door at the back of the shop floor.
I expect another report when you land in Europe.
Of course.
He disconnected the line and put the headset back in his pocket.
Gadai was right.
Obrecht had indeed been useful.
Billions of dollars in Afghan heroin revenues had been laundered with his assistance. More than half of the profits had already been paid out by Taj to secure the loyalty of the many militant groups operating in Pakistan. Fortunately, Louis Gould was significantly cheaper. In fact, it would have been amusing to offer him nothing for killing Mitrap. Taj suspected the assassin would have agreed enthusiastically. But this was no time to take unnecessary risks. In the event that Gould saw the ad and managed to succeed, the 15 million he'd been promised would be money well spent. While it seemed absurd to put this many resources toward killing one man, it would be even more imprudent to underestimate Mitrap's ability to interfere with his plans. With the CIA man gone, Kennedy's teeth would be pulled. She and her pathetic country would be blind and defenseless in the face of what was to come. Taj entered a broad corridor and saw President Chutani speaking with Umar Shirani, the Army's chief of staff. They turned toward him, and Chutani raised a hand in greeting.
Ahmed, thank you for coming. I trust your journey was a good one?
It was, Taj said, avoiding the man's gaze. Thank you for asking, sir.
Shirani looked on with disdain and then enveloped Taj's hand in an unusually deferential grip. The general was one of the most influential men in the country, and, like so many others, considered Taj weak. Today, though, he found his position diminished. The security at these nuclear sites was his responsibility, and this was the second attack on one in as many months. Taken together with Chutani's growing stature and recent American threats to reduce military aid, the aging four-star's relevance was beginning to slip.
"What has the ISI learned?" the president asked.
"A great deal," Taj said. "The attack was perpetrated by a Taliban group based in Banu. Their leader blew himself up when my men attempted to capture him, and a number of his people are attempting to make it to the Afghan border. Obviously, we're trying to take them alive in order to carry out interrogations. Discovering whether further facilities have been targeted is our top priority."
This was, of course, completely untrue. Taj's S-Wing operatives would put on a worthy show, but the surviving Taliban would die when an IED they were assembling detonated. They'd understood the inevitability of their martyrdom from the moment that Taj had provided them with the location of the nuclear facility.
"Good work, Ahmed. As always, I'm grateful to have you."
"If identifying these groups is so easy," Shirani said, "perhaps the director would be so kind as to give me a warning next time one is planning something like this?"
The general's attempt to deflect blame was desperate and pathetic. Clearly he had become too comfortable hiding behind the power of his office.
"You must accept my apologies for not having this information in time for you to fortify your defenses," Taj said deferentially. "Rest assured that we are redoubling our efforts to penetrate these radical groups."
While Shirani and Chutani would assume it was unintentional, the message was clear. It was the Army's job to be in a constant state of readiness. The ISI wasn't responsible for rousing them from their stupor in time for them to perform their duties.
"It's possible that there could be secondary attacks," Taj continued. "I would strongly urge you to make certain your men are on alert."
"They are always on alert,"
Shirani said, a bit too forcefully. President Chutani frowned noticeably.
"All evidence to the contrary, Omar. You should be grateful to Ahmed for his support."
Shirani's voice sounded a bit strained when he spoke again.
"Of course. I'm grateful for any assistance the ISI can provide. We all have the same goals."
"Indeed," Chutani agreed. "We are all dedicated to keeping these facilities secure.
Unfortunately, much of the money earmarked for that task has been spent on other projects.
Sir, I must protest, Shirani said. You seem to be implying some kind of impropriety on the part of the army. Terrorists like these are undoubtedly a danger, but clearly not the only one, or even the most significant one. Creating the kind of security that would be unbreachable by a small terrorist group would be a simple matter if we weren't concerned about being discovered by the Indians and Americans. Our primary goal must be protecting ourselves from a first strike by one of those countries.
I am not naive in these matters, Umar, but I wonder if our concern over foreign enemies is devolving into paranoia. If we lose a warhead to one of these groups and it's used, the Americans' retaliation would be the end of our country as we know it. No, Pakistan has a chance at greatness, but we're squandering it with these games. America learned its lesson in Iraq and Afghanistan, and India doesn't need to attack to defeat us. They're already winning with their progress. They've outstripped us in everything, from education to economic growth to diplomacy. That's the future, Umar. It is from those things that security flows, not weapons.
Shirani opened his mouth to object, but Chutani held up a hand, silencing the soldier.
It's convenient to fan the flames of extremism in the short term, but now we're in danger of being engulfed ourselves. Changes must be made. The country has to modernize and come together. Our future can't be financed with charity from countries that fear we're on the verge of collapse. Trust, respect, wealth, these are the things that must be cultivated.
What are you proposing? Shirani said suspiciously.
The expansion of the Hushab reactor will be halted, Chutani said, with a tone that suggested the decision wasn't up for debate. As will all production of weapons-grade fissile material. The weapons we have are more than enough to deter an attack.
Shirani was too stunned to respond, so Chutani continued.
Further, the defense of our nuclear arsenal will be shifted from the army to the ISI, effective immediately.
Taj feigned surprise, though it was the outcome he'd been working toward for more than 2 years.
Mr. President, I don't...
It's done, Ahmed. You and General Shirani will start coordinating the transition right away.
Yes, sir, Taj said, watching Shirani's face out of the corner of his eye. It was an incredible insult, but the soldier managed to hide his rage. Undoubtedly, he was calculating the extent of his own power versus Chutani's and the feasibility of engineering a coup. Shirani's gaze finally shifted to Taj, and this time he didn't bother to hide his contempt. Instead of looking away, as was his custom, Taj met the man's stare. It was time to allow Umar Shirani a brief, unobstructed glimpse into the heart of his new master.
Chapter 14. The Farm. Outside Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, USA. Louis Gould pretended to study the enormous scale model, but was actually concentrating on the other men in the room. He had to stay calm and professional. The smallest slip was almost guaranteed to end in his death. Mike Nash, whom he knew very little about, had been called away. That left three men. Stan Hurley wasn't just old, he was ancient. It was hard to separate legend from fact with regard to his past, but if even half of the information out there was true, Hurley had at one time been very dangerous. Now, though, he was just a bag of bones, with a death hack and a perceptible limp. Taking the geriatric bastard seriously would require some effort, but completely dismissing him would be careless. Coleman was a different matter. He was probably pushing 50, but still looked like he was chiseled out of stone. As a former SEAL, it was a given that he was a top operator. The fact that Rapp chose to work with him suggested he was a standout in a fraternity that only accepted standouts. The difference between qualifying for the Olympics and walking away with gold. If he had any weaknesses, they were psychological. He came off as a bit of a Boy Scout, a man who believed too much in God, country, and the camaraderie of battle. Finally, there was Mitch Rapp, a man in a category all his own. No discernible physical or mental weaknesses. Uncanny instincts, no hesitation, no remorse. Decades of experience and training. Simply put, one of the most dangerous men who ever lived. Despite all that combined history, the three killers were hanging on his every word. It would be easier to start thinking of them as idiots, to let his well-earned arrogance kick in and categorize them as typical marks. He'd tried to kill Rapp twice before and failed, even though he'd had the element of surprise both times. It was a fact that Gould was already beginning to rationalize away, and he fought against that tendency. The day he forgot who he was up against was the day he ended up with a bullet in his head. "I know you've been planning this since the day you signed on with Obrecht," Rapp said. "What have you got?" What he had was an entire plan from start to finish. Ironically, though, it was entirely inspired by Leo Obrecht, the man Rapp incorrectly believed was the target of this operation. "Work will be done primarily at the owner's home in Switzerland. We are looking to take the most obvious route to finding a good fit." Obrecht knew the CIA was after him, and assumed that they would have no choice but to mount an assault on the mansion. Clearly, he hoped that Gould could convince them to carry out the operation using the most obvious strategy. It would be an easy sell, particularly to Coleman. Soldiers tended to look at battlefields in predictable ways, and the Navy man would have a strong bias toward the KISS principle. Keep it simple, stupid. Gould used a pull cue to tap a rocky knoll to the west of the property's iron gate. "This is the highest point in the area, and it's right where you want it. Range to the wall is just over 600 meters, and the wind tends to get disrupted by the ridgeline to the south. Easy sniper range." Coleman nodded. "My guys have been up there. It's the only place high enough to get a good view over the wall, and you can see right through the gate. Cover's good, and there are multiple lines of retreat if it comes to that."
"What about the tunnel?"
Hurley said. "I had Witt crawl down there and take a look. He found the entrance but didn't go inside in case there were sensors. Based on the pictures he took, the door's steel. No way to know how thick, no visible way to open it." Gould nodded. "There's a hidden keypad with a 12-digit combination. I tracked down the man who installed it and convinced him to put in a back door when he serviced the unit. The tunnel comes out behind a shelf in Obrecht's basement."
"Convinced him?" Coleman said.
In truth, Obrecht had given Gould a personal code that could be temporarily activated should the assassin ever need to access the mansion. "People tend to get real cooperative when you have a gun in their mouth," Gould said. Hurley took a swig of his bourbon.
"True that."
Gould pointed at the representation of the tunnel entrance. "I'd suggest that me and Mitch go in through there just before 5 o'clock.
"Why 5? Rapp said. "That's still daylight."
"Yeah, but it's also happy hour. Obrecht's careful about never creating identifiable routines outside the mansion, but inside he feels safe. As near as I can tell, he opens a bottle of expensive French wine and lights a Cuban in his study at 5 on the dot every day. We grab him there, slip him back out the tunnel, and he's on your plane in an hour."
Gould let his eyes linger on Rapp, but the man was impossible to read. Was he buying all this?
"In my experience, wine snobs like to choose their bottle based on their mood," Rapp said. "Wouldn't that put him in the basement with us just before 5?
It was yet another reminder of why the CIA assassin was not to be underestimated. Gould would have asked the same question, but he wasn't sure he'd have come up with it that quickly.
"Good thought, but Obrecht had an auxiliary wine cooler installed in his den. He picks his vintage from there, and if he restocks it on a regular schedule, I don't know what that schedule is."
"The 12 guards we've identified mostly stay outside," Rapp said. "Are there dedicated interior guards that we don't know about?"
"Not that I've ever seen," Gould said. "Obrecht likes his privacy and sticks to a few servants who've been trained to stay out of his way. But since you're telling me he's laid on additional security, I can't swear to that."
"I think there's a good chance you're right," Coleman said. "We've been watching the windows, and we're not seeing anyone we don't recognize as a member of the core security team."
"So we have 12 men, primarily in outdoor postings," Hurley said. "All well-armed, solid operators in defensible positions. All recently hired, so not one of them is going to be bored or complacent. That's not a great scenario for us."
"I agree," Gould said. "Trust me when I tell you that I'm not happy about being half of a two-man team
if something goes wrong and all those guys come running through the door with guns blazing. But I'm not seeing a lot of alternatives. The men across from him looked at each other for a moment. Finally, Rapp spoke. Three. What? You're not half of a two-man team. You're a third of a three-man team. A while back, Hurley knocked on the gate and gave one of Obrecht's guards a fake Interpol business card. He told him to let Obrecht know that Interpol was interested in talking to him about you. Obrecht's secretary just called and set up an appointment at the mansion for the day after tomorrow. Gould allowed a smile to spread across his face. Not for the reason the other men in the room thought, though. Personal and work history would be verified through Interpol. That line in the Post ad had perplexed him. Now it was crystal clear. Obrecht had figured out who Hurley was and would be ready for him. What time? Gould said, still processing how this new piece of information would affect him. 3 o'clock, Rapp said. It was perfect. The entire thing was starting to look like child's play. Obrecht and his men would not only know that the obvious route would be Gould coming through the tunnel and putting his backup on the high ground, but they'd know the time of the breach. That works even better, Gould said finally. He'll meet with Stan in his office, which is easier to access from the basement than his den. And we have a third man that no one's going to expect. Heck, if it comes to it, we could even play like we've taken Stan hostage.
So you can use me as a human shield?
Hurley said. My ass! You just follow my lead, Pops. I won't let anything happen to you. Hurley lunged, but Rapp saw it coming and held him back. The Frenchman stood his ground, a broad grin on his face. He was starting to feel almost giddy about the situation. Everything was lining up in his favor. It was beginning to feel like fate. He was going to be the man who killed Mitch Rapp. Careful, Gould said, leaning over the plastic representation of Obrecht's estate. We don't want you breaking a hip before we even get there.
Keep talking, kid, while you still can.
Gould laughed and walked to the bar. Maybe we should talk about what I get when I pull this off, he said, reaching over and retrieving a beer from the refrigerator on the other side. Of course, the real answer was 15 million euros and the undisputed status of being the best in the world. But these morons didn't know that. I thought we already covered that subject, Rapp said as the others looked on. You're not killing me? That doesn't seem like much for me handing you a man like Leo Obrecht.
Seems like a lot to me, Hurley said.
Gould shifted his gaze to the old man and twisted the top off his beer. At first, he thought this nursing home reject would be a nice cherry on top of Rapp's corpse. Doing both of them at once would be something people in the business would talk about for the next 100 years. After thinking about it, though, maybe he'd just cripple the man. Let him spend the rest of his short life sitting in a wheelchair, crapping himself, and knowing that he wasn't even worth a bullet. If I remember right, Kennedy said something about putting me on retainer. Rapp didn't answer immediately, instead just staring through him with those black eyes. Gould wouldn't allow himself to look away, but he felt his confidence falter. But I didn't, Rapp said finally. All I'm offering you is a chance to go back to your wife and daughter. If you ever take another contract, you won't live long enough to collect the money. Seems like you could use someone with my skills, Gould said. The conversation was meaningless, but he refused to back down. Who was Rapp kidding? He'd gotten lucky in Afghanistan. If Gould's employer hadn't betrayed him, the great Mitch Rapp would already be dead. And him surviving the explosion at his house years before had been a combination of dumb luck and Gould overcomplicating the hit by trying to make it look like an accident. Listen to me, Louis. Take the deal. Watch your daughter grow up. Get old with your wife. Stan's right. That's a lot. Chapter 15 Rome, Italy. Kabir Galdai checked the map on his phone as he strolled casually up the sidewalk. The weather was sunny and cool, allowing for a collared coat and bulky sunglasses. Neither provided sufficient anonymity to make him feel comfortable. Sending him personally to Rome
was one of Ahmed Taj's rare tactical mistakes. There were any number of well-trained ISI operatives who could have successfully completed the mission. It was impossible, in the digital era, to travel unphotographed, and too risky for someone with Gadai's high profile to enter an EU country under an alias. So, the Italians had a record of his arrival under the rather thin guise of a security review being carried out at Pakistan's London embassy. Taj's obsession with the Rickman files seemed to grow with every passing day. Admittedly, accessing the information they contained would be the greatest intelligence coup in the last 70 years, but Taj seemed to be forgetting that his plan had never required them. His focus was beginning to wander, and for the first time, Gadai could see his insatiable greed for power affecting his judgment. It was this that made Gadai's physical presence in Rome even more dangerous. Their preparations were at a critical juncture, and he was very much needed in Islamabad. Someone had to monitor the endless details of Taj's plot, and he was the only man other than the director himself who had knowledge of all its facets. Further, arrangements for the U.S. Secretary of State's delegation were in motion and were proving to be more time-consuming than he had anticipated. A former Secret Service executive named Jack Warch was spearheading the American side of the security measures, and he seemed almost childlike in his need to question every detail. The state dinner was the key to Taj's plan, and Gadai would not let it be endangered by a single, dangerously inquisitive consultant. He had taken to dealing with the man personally, and being outside the country was jeopardizing his control over the situation. Across the lightly traveled street, a turn-of-the-century apartment building gave way to a football pitch. The open field was separated from the sidewalk by a chain-link fence designed less for security than to keep errant balls out of the road. Beyond the well-tended grass was a modern, concrete structure that stood in stark contrast to the ancient suburb surrounding it. Behind the rows of reflective windows was the middle school attended by Isabella Accorso's 16-year-old daughter. No children were visible, which was to be expected at that time of the morning. They would briefly appear between classes at various points during the day, with a somewhat longer break for lunch. In the afternoon, sporting activities that these Westerners happily allowed their daughters to participate in were held. Gadai dug his hands into his pockets and resisted shaking his head in disgust. They cared nothing for purity or chastity. The women in this country were allowed to do whatever they wished. The very thought of his own daughter running across that field with bare legs and arms filled him with rage. He would beat her to death without a moment's remorse, and the Islamic courts would support his decision wholeheartedly. Gadai cut across a cobbled courtyard and entered the lobby of the apartment building at the back of it. He ignored the elevator and instead took the stairs, climbing five stories before exiting into an unoccupied corridor. He walked purposefully toward the fourth door on the right, adjusting his collar and letting his eyes sweep the intersection between wall and ceiling to confirm the reported lack of cameras. He used the key he'd been provided to enter, immediately closing the door behind him and examining the small space. It was typical of the area: plaster walls, a wood floor warped with age, and a small galley kitchen full of cheap appliances. Having been leased only days before, it was devoid of furniture. The only sign of habitation was a few boxes of food on the countertop and a teapot on the stove. Latif Dogar appeared in the entrance to the bedroom and nodded respectfully. "Captain Gadai, how was your journey?" He ignored the question, striding across the living area and brushing past the man. In the bedroom there was a sleeping area consisting of blankets piled on the floor and a wall covered with photos. Each depicted the same young girl. Most were close-ups of her playing football in front of her school, the focus often not on her face but on her young body and obscene shorts. "Where did you get these?" "They were left by the surveillance team, Captain. Are you so stupid that you need them to recognize your target?" "No, Captain." "Then destroy them." "Yes, sir." Perhaps Taj hadn't been so unwise to send him after all. The fact that these photos were ever printed was inexcusable, but hanging them on the wall verged on insubordination. It would be something he would have dealt with quite harshly if Taj hadn't already arranged for these men to disappear when they returned to Pakistan. The shades were almost completely closed,
and Adai knelt to peer through the 3-centimeter crack at the bottom. It offered an unobstructed view of the school at a reported range of 212 meters. The fence would have the potential to deflect a shot, but that wasn't important. It was the video image he was interested in, and it would be quite acceptable. Adai went to a long metal case resting against the wall and turned the combination dials on it. Inside was a rather unusual item that he held out to Dogar. The assassin took it, turning it over in his hands with a confused expression.
This isn't a gun.
He was entirely correct. It was a shortened plastic rifle stock with a hand grip at the front designed for birdwatchers to hold cameras and spotting scopes steady. It had been far easier to bring into the EU than a firearm, and was impervious to both accidents and the stupidity that the Pakistani team had displayed thus far. Dogar examined the video camera mounted on it, taking inventory of the controls and noting the crosshairs on the zoom lens.
Am I to continue surveillance with this?
Gadai retrieved the laptop that had been sharing the case and turned it on. Has the broadband connection been installed?
Yes, as you requested. We've verified upload speeds of 4 megabits per second.
Turn on the camera and aim it out the window. He did as he was told, and the image of the school appeared on the laptop screen. Do you see the woman on the sidewalk? Line up on her head. Dadai watched as the crosshairs centered on her right temple. It was all but indistinguishable from a rifle scope.
Perfect.
Chapter 16. Near Lake Constance, Switzerland. The screen on the van's dashboard had been built to look like a normal GPS, but was in fact something far more sophisticated. Mitch Rapp watched the video feed being beamed to the screen from a drone controlled by Marcus Dumont. Most of the image consisted of steeply rolling, heavily forested terrain. The empty rural highway they were driving along cut across the left edge, running north to south. 5 miles to the east, he could see the winding road that dead-ended into Leo Obrecht's mansion, also devoid of traffic. It was Wednesday morning, and this area was primarily a weekend retreat for Switzerland's wealthy set.
"We're coming up on the drop site," the driver said. "3 minutes."
Rapp didn't know much about Maria Glauser, other than she spoke German with the appropriate Swiss accent, and knew the area like the back of her hand. Nash had worked with her in the past and said she was one of the most exacting people he'd ever met. It was a quality Rapp demanded in anyone supporting his ops. So far, she hadn't disappointed. The activity in the rear of the van intensified, but Rapp didn't look back. Instead, he began stripping off his sweatpants and jacket, revealing camouflage fatigues beneath. Nothing about this operation was ideal, and the fact that they had to set out in broad daylight to coincide with Hurley's appointment was just one of a long list of problems. There'd been a fair amount of debate as to whether to go in posing as hikers, but he finally decided against it. There were no trails in the area, making the tried-and-true lost backpacker cover a little far-fetched. And while Rapp's beard and shaggy hair made him a little hard to pin down, Coleman and his men looked exactly like the elite soldiers they were.
"The bridge is just ahead," Glauser said.
"We're a go," Rapp said loud enough for the men in back to hear. "The video feed looks clear, no cars in sight." They crossed over a slow-moving stream about 5 yards wide, and Glauser eased onto the shoulder.
"I'll have vehicles at the designated extraction points," she said, keeping her eye on the side-view mirror. "But we're not going to bring them in until the last minute. It could attract attention."
"Just make sure they're there," Rapp said, throwing open the passenger door as his team piled out of the back. "We'll be moving fast, and there could be people behind us."
"They'll be here, I guarantee it."
Rapp and his team were already running down the steep stream bank toward the water when she pulled away. The grass had grown to almost the height of a man beneath the bridge, and Rapp sank a good 6 inches into the mud as he pushed through. The backpacks were exactly where Glauser said they'd be, each subtly marked to identify their owners, Rapp, Gould, Coleman, and Joe Maslick. They started east, taking advantage of the sparser foliage near the water to keep their pace up. The team split at a fork in the stream 20 minutes in, Maslick taking the south branch, which would lead him to a position above the entrance to Obrecht's escape tunnel. With his injured shoulder, he was a potential liability in a running fight. dug in with a rifle on a tripod, he'd be close to 100% effective. The rest of them took the North Fork, heading for the High Point, west of Obrecht's mansion. There they'd rendezvous with Charlie Wicker and Bruno McGraw, who had been reconning the area. Eventually they were forced to abandon the stream bed and start up the knoll. The angle of the terrain and the dense foliage slowed their progress to a 17-minute-mile pace. It felt painfully slow, but it was roughly what Rapp had planned for. They kept to the west, putting the bulk of the knoll between them and Obrecht's property. Wick hadn't found any surveillance equipment or sensors, so they didn't have to worry about staying completely silent. "Closing in on your position," Rapp said into his throat mic as they crested the ridge. "Come on," Wicker responded. They slowed, organizing into a single line with 25-foot intervals. Gould had been solid on the climb and fell into second position, with Coleman keeping a close eye on him from behind. Rapp was pretty sure Gould was a few cards short of a full deck, but even he wasn't crazy enough to make a move with that kind of firepower on his six. The slope started to descend slightly, and Rapp raised a fist before coming to a stop. Something felt wrong, but he couldn't put his finger on it. What little wind there was beneath the clear sky didn't have enough force to penetrate the forest. The gurgle of water had been left far behind, and they hadn't seen any sign of the deer that were indigenous to the area. Nothing but silence and the scent of pine. What was it? His question was answered a moment later. "On your 11 o'clock, Mitch," Wicker's voice over his earpiece. "Don't shoot." A bush covered in wildflowers rustled about 20 yards away and then blended back into the landscape. Rapp started forward again, covering the first 30 feet to Wicker's position in a crouch. When the roof of Obrecht's mansion came into view through the trees, Rapp dropped and slithered the rest of the way on his stomach. Even less than an arm's length from Wicker, the sniper was nearly invisible. He had created a tube from woven sticks and covered it in live plants before sliding in. All Rapp could see was part of his rifle's silencer and the vague outline of the unertal scope the man favored. At 5'6" and barely 140 pounds, Charlie Wicker wasn't what most people would picture when they thought of SEAL Team 6. In a fight, though, Rapp considered him one of the deadliest men alive. "What have we got, Wick?"
"Not much has changed. 12 guards, each with a sidearm and an assault rifle. No vehicles in or out. A delivery truck comes every few days, but they don't let it inside. Supplies are passed through the small gate to the south. That's where the servants come in and out, too, but not very often. Most seem to be living on premises."
"Any pattern?"
"Nope."
The Swiss banker had clearly gone to ground. He was expecting the CIA to make a play, and if he couldn't stop it, he was going to make sure things got bloody. Rapp pulled out a small spotting scope and scanned the property. Gould was right. The knoll they were on had an excellent line of sight. The main gate was in full view, and they were high enough to be able to take in a significant portion of the courtyard. Not that there was much to see. A few fountains, some tasteful landscaping, and a handful of armed men. "I only see 4 guards, Rapp said.
"That's the minimum. If we can choose our moment, we can probably get 6. That still leaves the other half, though."
Rapp frowned. "The plan is quiet in and quiet out. Leave those guys guarding their dicks. But if we do have to start shooting, I can guarantee you we're not going to be choosing the moment."
"Then I'd count on having to deal with at least 8 serious bad guys."
"You've been down to the tunnel from here?"
"Yeah."
"It's clear all the way?"
"Too much wildlife for sensors or tripwires. They'd be dealing with false alarms all day."
"Any surprises?"
"You've got to be really careful in the last couple 100 meters. That's where the guys on top of the wall have a view of your position. Because of all the animals, you could brush a bush or two on your way in, but 3 or 4 might get you in trouble."
Rapp nodded and started slithering backward, making sure the building was out of view, before standing and returning to the clearing at the apex of the knoll. Coleman had pulled a large piece of netting from his pack and was collecting plants that he'd use to build his own camouflage position. Gould was crouched next to a tree, blending in with the gnarled trunk. Rapp motioned him over. "Wick says 2 hours. Scott, I assume that's going to be enough time to set up here?" The former SEAL nodded. "We'll be locked and loaded well before you get there." "All right." He looked at Gould.
You ready? The Frenchman had smeared his face with green paint, making it difficult to read his expression.
Yeah.
You've been down there before, Rapp said, so you lead out. In truth, Rapp knew exactly where they were going, having studied both the detailed overhead photos and Dumont's model. But there was no way he was going to let Gould get behind him without Coleman watching. The former French legionnaire moved well. He kept a solid pace down the steep slope, silent and eyes constantly moving. His attentiveness to their surroundings was especially critical because Rapp was focused on the silenced Glock 17 in Gould's hand. Coleman had suggested loading it with blanks, but Gould wasn't going to miss something that obvious. Besides, if things went wrong, his skills would be very much in demand. The hope was that his instinct for self-preservation would keep that weapon aimed in the right direction. Scott Coleman kept collecting plants for another 5 minutes after losing sight of the two men and then switched to a frequency that Rapp had set up to exclude Louis Gould.
Okay, we're clear.
He started replacing the plants while Wicker slipped out of the shelter he'd built and disappeared into the trees with Bruno McGraw on his tail. Coleman finished with the plants and used a dead branch to scrape away any boot prints that had defined themselves too clearly in the soft earth. A quick look around the clearing suggested it was more or less back the way they'd found it. Not that it would fool anyone like him, but in the unlikely event the Swiss cops came up here, they wouldn't find anything unusual. Coleman grabbed a spotting scope and slid into Wicker's shelter, smiling when he realized that his feet just barely touched the back. Wick was a full 5 inches shorter than him, but knowing the plan, he'd made the shelter a perfect fit for his boss. With the scope to his eye, Coleman swept the courtyard below. This was undoubtedly the best seat in the house, and he wasn't sure surrendering the high ground was a good idea. It was going to cut the effectiveness of his team by at least 70%, but there was nothing he could do about it. A little less than a half an hour passed before Bruno McGraw's voice crackled over his earpiece.
We've reached the secondary site, starting setup.
Hopefully the radio signal reached Rapp. They'd identified a few dead spots on the way to the tunnel entrance. There was no way to confirm, though. Gould thought he was getting all the radio chatter, and a response from Rapp would tip the man off.
Roger that, Coleman said.
It was another 23 minutes before he spotted an old Citroën driving up the road below. Stan Hurley had the window open, and the cigarette smoke flowing from it was visible through the scope. Right on time. A guard came out of the door-sized steel grate south of the gate and signaled for the car to stop. It was exactly how Coleman would have set it up. Don't let the vehicle get too close in case it contained explosives. Hurley stepped out and held up a set of fake Interpol credentials. Coleman couldn't hear what was being said, but he could clearly see the irritation on the old man's face while he was being frisked. Along the wall, the guards were all paying attention, but not getting overly focused on the man in case it was a diversion. Coleman let out a quiet breath. They looked to be even better than he'd expected. Reason number 98, to hope that this didn't turn into a shooting war. Hurley was led to the gate, where another armed guard let him through. After that, Coleman lost line of sight.
Hurley's in. I'm starting to break down the shelter now. Should be approaching your position in approximately 30.
Roger that,
Wick responded. Coleman switched to the frequency accessible by Gould.
Hurley's inside the wall, and we're ready to rock.
Chapter 17. The heavily reinforced gate swung open, and Hurley shuffled through with a stoop meant to make him appear even older than he was. It didn't have the intended effect of making Obrecht's security overconfident, though. The man behind him maintained a careful interval and had his hands wrapped firmly around a Heckler & Koch G36 assault rifle. The one in front kept the gate between them as Hurley passed. 10 yards away, another armed man watched through mirrored sunglasses. The remaining guards were focused elsewhere and were positioned in a way that would make the most of their manpower. The gate closed behind him, and he used the loud clang as an excuse to glance back. The wall seemed higher than the reported 12 feet, and it was as smooth inside as it was out. There were strategically placed scaffolds along it, some hastily framed out of unpainted lumber, and others more professionally executed from steel and concrete. Cover was nearly non-existent.
The largest tree was about 6 inches in diameter, leaving nothing more than a few widely spaced fountains and a couple of parked cars. A sprint across that courtyard, particularly at the speed his new hip would allow, wasn't going to end well. "Sir," the guard behind him said in accented English, "if you please." Hurley limped to an X-ray machine that looked like a more sophisticated version of something you'd find at JFK.
"Is this really necessary?"
"I'm sorry for the inconvenience," the man said in a tone that suggested he wasn't. "If you could please remove your jacket and shoes, and empty your pockets." He did as he was told, and then turned to walk to the other side of the conveyor, but was immediately stopped. "Your belt, too, sir." He smiled accommodatingly, but felt a surge of nervousness as he removed it. It had been made to order in Asia back in the 70s. The buckle was secured to the leather by a 2-inch-long metal strip that had been sharpened on all sides. It was sewn in with permanent stitches, but the pattern and thread were purposely weak. One hard jerk, and it would break free, giving him a weapon that was complete crap, but still better than nothing.
"A lot of security,"
Hurley observed, trying to distract the man looking at the X-ray screen. The belt had been all over the world, passing through even Israel's airports more times than he could count. Still, this rundown was anything but routine. "Yes, sir," he said, not looking up. The conveyor paused for a moment, and Hurley focused on the man's gun. It'd be a hell of a way to go out, grabbing the guy's weapon and spraying down the courtyard. Just wishful thinking, though. If he so much as raised his voice, they'd immediately harden up on Obrecht. The operation would be finished before it even started. No, if they questioned the belt, he'd tell the truth, that he'd bought it outside a Thai whorehouse before most of the men around him were even born. What did he know about how belt buckles were attached to belts? It turned out to be unnecessary. His things came rolling out of the machine unchallenged while he was being wanded. A moment later he was fully dressed and moving toward the mansion. The guard was 2 paces ahead as they started up the broad marble staircase leading to the front door. He had a sidearm that was within reach, but he wouldn't give it up easily. Even with surprise on his side, Hurley questioned how he would fare against the man. 20, even 10 years ago, he wouldn't have given it a second thought. A quick twist of the neck, accompanied by the quiet crunch of vertebrae, and it would be done. The chemotherapy and the hip surgery had taken more out of him than he let on, though. If Rapp knew the real extent of it, he'd have left him in West Virginia. But there was no way Hurley was going to fade away in a rocking chair while that piece of shit Louis Gould replaced him. They stayed on the first floor, walking through a palatial entry hall lined with antique furniture and original portraits of people spanning a good 5 centuries. Most were probably Obrecht's ancestors and all looked like they were posing with sticks up their asses. Yet another reminder that crime actually did pay. "Wait in here."
"Thank you,"
Hurley said, stepping inside a spacious parlor.
"You know when Mr. Obrecht will be available?"
One of the few advantages of being his age was that hearing aids were expected. His were tied into Coleman's tactical radio setup and had microphones that picked up his voice as well as the ambient sound around him. He depressed a button on the key fob in his pocket to toggle the transmit function and broadcast the man's answer to Rapp. They wouldn't be able to coordinate the op to the second, but if Obrecht was as anal retentive as he was reputed to be, they'd be able to nail it to within a minute or so.
"I don't know. Could you give me some idea? I need to be back for—"
The door closed, leaving Hurley staring at the ornately carved back of it.
Prick.
He walked around for a few minutes, pretending to look at the expensive furnishings and finally settling into a chair near a set of west-facing windows. 2 guards were visible, but there was nothing to see that Dumont's drone hadn't picked up. Hurley suspected the room was full of hidden cameras and microphones, making it a bit challenging to communicate. He stood and depressed the key fob button again.
"Just one time I'd like it not to be hurry up and wait,"
he muttered angrily, as if to himself.
"I don't know how long Obrecht expects me to sit by the door watching the sun go down. Like I don't have better things to do."
"Confirm," Rapp said over his fake hearing aid. "You're alone on the first floor, windows facing west."
"Yeah, just great."
"Understood. Stand by. We're 3 minutes from the tunnel entrance." Hurley began pacing, feeling the irritation he was supposed to be faking turn real.
He was accustomed to being on the action side of these ops, and being dead in the water while Rapp crawled to the dirt and Coleman set up sniper positions was driving him insane. He got a little satisfaction from imagining opening the door and smashing that Euro-trash Merc's head in with a priceless statuette. And the image of Rapp and that frog showing up to find Obrecht already tied and gagged was downright uplifting. The mission he'd been charged with, though, was very different. Nothing more than confirming the banker's location in the house and keeping him occupied with conversation until the two younger men could come to the rescue. But that wasn't the worst of it. In order to create even more confusion, he was to act like a second hostage if they were confronted by Obrecht's security. The theory was that it would give Hurley the element of surprise, but he wasn't sure that Rapp really believed he was still capable of taking out anyone tougher than a Girl Scout. He sat again, staring at a blank section of wall, and thinking back to when the 22-year-old Mitch Rapp had showed up at his training facility. Some college boy lacrosse player who didn't know one end of a gun from another. Hurley had wiped the floor with a sniveling little puke. And despite decades of friendship and countless